Devoncast
from Radio X.
Attention, air raid alert. Proceed to the nearest shelter.
That's a sound that's become all too familiar to people living in Ukraine. An air raid warning going off in the middle of the night. Later in this edition of Devoncast, we'll talk to a Devon MP who was caught up in the middle of one such warning. I'm Guy Henderson, and I'm joined in the studio today by my local democracy reporting service colleague Alison Stevenson, and by our guest councillor Neil Jory, who'll be talking about railways, housing and the economy of West Devon, and why the smallest district council in the county has been described as punching above its weight when it comes to delivering services. We'll be hearing from Torbay Liberal Democrat MP Steve Darling about his experiences during that fact-finding visit to Ukraine, and a local councillor explains to us why she won't apologise for saying shame on you to her local authority's chief executive. We also hear big news of a big boost for a project in Torridge.
But first, we talked to Councillor Neil Jury, who's been a Conservative district councillor in West Devon since 2015 and was leader of West Devon Borough Council from 2019 to 2023, before an alliance of independent Liberal Democrat, Green and Labour councillors took control. He's now leader of the Conservative group and lead member for the economy, and has ambitions to be the next county councillor for Okehampton Rural come the Devon County Council elections in May. Welcome, Councillor Jury, and thank you for coming into the studio today.
That's my pleasure, Alison. Thank you for the invite.
Now, the last time I saw you was at the turf cutting ceremony of the Okehampton Interchange recently, a new railway station being built on the outskirts of the market town, which will serve commuters to Exeter and beyond. This is going to act as a busy transport hub for the whole of the borough, as well as North Cornwall, with a 200-space car park. So this follows the return of passenger services from Okehampton to Exeter. Tell me why the town needed a second railway station, because there's already one in the town already, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. There's a station in the town has been really, really successful, the reintroduction of rail services. Over 500,000 passenger journeys in the first 2 years of operation. So it's been a fantastic success story, I think. It was always part of the plan to make that facility available to a wider audience. In the absence of being able, at least in the short term, to extend that line any further, we wanted to make sure that it was accessible to people in the wider region, so the rest of West Devon and as far afield as North Cornwall. And clearly the old station is in a difficult to access part of Okehampton. It's great for people in Okehampton. We wanted to bring something in that was easier to connect to, and there was a site available which is owned by Devon County Council, just off the A30, where a car park could also be added, and we wanted to build in some other links as well, so buses and cycles and all of that sort of thing would be able to connect to that new facility. It's on the east side of Okehampton, where a lot of new development is taking place, and so will service those houses and also the industrial areas of Okehampton as well. So we felt really important to be able to ramp up that facility and make full use of it.
And to get that money, I think it's £30 million, isn't it? And that's that whole project's going to be administered by West Devon Borough Council.
Yeah, West Devon Borough Council is the lead council. We could not have done anything without Devon County Council, and Devon have provided quite a lot of the funding. There's been funding that's come from central government as well as part of the Levelling Up Fund. And, of course, Network Rail and GWR are also involved in it. And I think the whole project has been one where the various agencies involved have worked really well together in order to get this off the ground. And I think we saw that in the ceremony last week. So, yeah, real success story for that part of Devon, I think.
OK, so it's bringing more people into Okehampton, but it also providing that service for commuters and shoppers to get to Exeter too.
Yeah, and if it takes traffic off the road coming into Exeter, that's also a bonus. If it allows more young people to access employment or college facilities or other services within Exeter, then it's obviously something that's worth having. And it's all part of the whole sort of green improvement as well in terms of getting traffic off the road.
So what impact has it had, though, on businesses, for example, and what do you expect it to achieve in terms of perhaps boosting the economy, not just visitor numbers, but perhaps businesses setting up in Okehampton?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think we've already seen that. I think we've seen it putting Okehampton on the map in a way. It's improved Okehampton's links. It's already well positioned on the A30. We've got some really vibrant industrial areas on that side of Okehampton who are all looking for a good, motivated, educated workforce as well. And there have been successes of businesses moving into that area because of its connections. So I think it's vital for all of those sort of things. It raises the profile of the town, it makes the town feel better, it's going to help, I'm sure, the town centre as well. And I think if you've got somewhere to live and you want your employees to live somewhere that is vibrant and forward looking, all of those are factors that add in. So it really is giving the whole local economy a boost.
As a borough council then, can you influence that at all?
We do influence that to a certain extent. I know we've certainly negotiated with some of the employers that have come into that area and been able to make sure that, you know, we can do things to help them to move in. I think we do. I mean, it's limited as to what we do because we've got a very small economy team, but we do what we can. So, you know, I think overall it's been very successful.
Okehampton has also set up a business improvement district recently, which I believe you're a board member of. You said there have been some discontent from some businesses over that. Why has it been so hard to get that off the ground?
OK, I'm not a board member at the moment. The idea would be that there will be someone who's from West Edinburgh Council who will be nominated to be on that board, but that hasn't gone through the council as yet. And we need to do that in collaboration with the board that's been set up. It's a community-led organisation. So this came as a result of businesses in town wanting to do something to be able to, I think, improve the town as a whole and work together. We've had a business improvement district that's worked very well in Tavistock. It's always difficult because it does involve a levy on the business rates. And there are some businesses, understandably, who will resist that additional cost, and I completely understand that. I think the other side of that particular coin is it does give businesses the opportunity to work together. It does give them a voice, collective voice, which they can talk to the local council and to other organisations as well. It should act as a catalyst for bringing more investment into the town as well, and for making sure that there's really good events and training for businesses and that sort of thing that takes place, because you've got a fund that you can use to do that. So there will always be, I think, people who feel that their money could be better spent, and I think that goes for any kind of levy of this type. I think the challenge over the next few years will be for the board to show that this is a benefit to Okehampton. And I really believe it will be, and I'm really keen to support it as much as I can.
Do you think it'd be a case of wait and see, really, for a lot of businesses, see what starts to happen and then they'll get on board?
I think it's a question of wait and see and what starts to happen. The Tavistock bid has been going for some time now. Many businesses are really supportive of the bid in Tavistock. There are still some in Tavistock who I think feel they'd rather not pay that levy. But the benefit that it brings generally, I think, particularly from larger and national chain businesses who pay quite a bit of money into the pot, is that collective work that the bid board can then do to promote events, work with local media, which I know, you know, the Tavistock bid does very effectively, I think, and to have a similar approach within Okehampton. And I really hope that it takes off and brings benefit to Okehampton, because that's got to be the bottom line. And I think, you know, we've even seen many of the bigger employers in Oakhampton on the industrial estates, welcoming this bid because they want High Street to thrive and survive, and they want Oakhampton to be a good place for their employees to live. So I'm really hopeful at this point, and I do want to give it as much support as I can.
Okay. Now, business itself, it can be quite a challenge in rural areas, can't it? I know that sometimes, West End is a massive area geographically, but the population is quite sparse, and it's classified as the smallest local authority area in the county with about around 57,000 people. The large rural expanses can be seen as a challenge when it comes to economic opportunities. In planning meetings, sometimes there's a bit of a dilemma, isn't there? When often it's a finely balanced argument between protecting the countryside and economic growth. Is that something you'd like to see change? And how do you think the two can work better together?
That's a really good question. And clearly, we do have many concerns when we're looking at development. In terms of the sustainability of that development. When you've got a very rural area and you haven't got public transport links, for example, that I suppose might serve to bring your customers to you or even your employees to you, it's perhaps difficult sometimes to see how that development might be justified. But I do think that rural businesses are worthy of support. I think it's really important that we get interesting, innovative and thriving businesses in the area. And I think as councillors, we've been very supportive on a number of situations where perhaps looking at the planning policy, we felt that there was too much of a steer towards the sustainability argument, and that therefore there shouldn't be a business there, as opposed to the benefits outweighing the potential harm that development brings. So there's always a bit of a balance there. I would like to see a bit more support for those rural businesses. I think we've given that in West Devon where we've needed to. And I think, you know, we've seen some very successful rural businesses setting up in the area. So it's a balance. We do need to look at planning policy. We do need to make sure we're protecting the countryside and the environment, but we also need to make sure we've got a thriving economy as well, and that's sometimes a difficult balance to hit.
But talking about businesses and planning there, to moving on to housing, very often young people have to move from an area to find work. They struggle to find homes. Last week we had a councillor from Cranbrook in East Devon on the podcast, and it was interesting hearing about Newtown, which was created really because two-thirds of the district is national landscape and there are restrictions on house building. Between Tavistock and Oakhampton is Dartmoor, obviously, which has similar if not tighter restrictions on housing. Has a Newtown ever been considered as an option for West Devon, especially since the borough has to build a lot more houses over the next 5 years to meet government targets and doesn't have a five-year land supply?
Really interesting question, and I can't dispute anything that you say. Clearly a big chunk of West Devon comes under the National Park for planning, and there are restrictions there. We do need to look at where we can build housing sustainably. We've been in a very successful joint local plan partnership with South Hams and Plymouth, where in the past Plymouth have taken more than their share of development because they wanted to do that, and we've been pretty successful in building new houses according to our previous plan. There's obviously been a change of direction with the new government, which wants to focus much more on the volume of house building and has increased targets right across the country. So you're absolutely right, we don't no longer have a five-year land supply, which puts our local plan at risk, and we do have that problem of where do we put it? We're sandwiched between the National Park on one side and the Tamar National Landscape on the other side. And we've got to make sure that we have development in sustainable towns and villages, which people want. But at the same time, young people do want to live locally and can't find the housing they need. So to come back to your question, when I was leader of the council, I had a conversation with the chief executive and some of the senior officers about surely the next iteration for us would be to build something like a new garden town or village somewhere and put all those services in one place and make sure that it was connected in the right ways to the infrastructure that any new development needs. I don't think I could say any more than that because that would be difficult. But I understand that idea is still is still there and is still being considered. And it may be the best option for us when we come to try and hit our housing targets in future. So, yeah, really good question. But we have thought of it and we have had those discussions.
That's very interesting because, I mean, when you talk about homes for young people, again, I think it was under your leadership, the council was wanting to create the first council homes in a generation. I think your colleagues in South Hams did something similar, one of which was in your ward at Lamerton, but it hasn't happened as yet. Why is that?
No, the Lamerton one in particular, we were looking at a site in Lamerton, which accorded with the developing neighbourhood plan in Lamerton at that time. After doing lots of work looking at the site, it was determined that the site itself wasn't viable because of drainage problems effectively on the site, which were going to make any solution that was brought forward to be really difficult to implement with the appropriate number of affordable homes and on the site. So at that point, we withdrew from that development and were looking elsewhere. The owner of the land has subsequently put in a new plan with a different way of dealing with the drainage, which has been given planning permission. So is now going ahead with a number of affordable homes on that site, which will be available for local families to go into as and when it gets built. But it's been approved. It's waiting at the moment for the Section 106 agreement to be signed off. So, yeah, there has been some development in that area.
Some development, that's good. But isn't it your wish, though, to have homes that you're in control of that you can have for social housing and that you can help the situation at the moment for people who are waiting for a house and can't afford one? A lot of these homes in reality are going to be open market homes, aren't they, which local people can't afford?
Yeah, and the policies that we have, the planning policies that we have, do require a proportion of each site once you get beyond five houses to be built for so-called affordable homes, and so they tend to go through the housing association route. And but it is true to say that one of the things we have considered is whether we should have our own housing stock. One of the problems you get with that is where does the cash come from? It's possible to borrow money at pretty reasonable rates, but you've still got to look at the viability of the whole transaction. So one thing that we have done recently is with some money that was made available by the government for refugees is to purchase outright some houses in Okehampton and in Tavistock, which are now being occupied by refugees. And those do now form part of our sort of fledgling housing stock, if you like. They're the first the first group of homes that we now own as a council, and gives us something which we can build around for the future. So yeah, there are things moving in that direction.
Okay, well, moving on to the council's performance, it was recently described as punching above its weight in a peer review for being well managed and showing good performance. Plenty of councils up and down the country are grappling with their finances and having to cut services. What makes West Devon so good at it?
I think that in some ways we were, I hesitate to use the word fortunate, but I think because of the size of the council, which you alluded to earlier, and its rurality, the problems, financial problems, that were going to hit councils probably hit us earlier than they hit other people. And so we dealt with it some time ago. In fact, even before I was a councillor, we merged our workforce with South Hams and started looking at new ways of working. Now, just having a joint workforce with South Ham's often quoted saves us in excess of £2 million a year, which on a budget for West Devon of around about 9 or 10 million is huge. So we had already started, even before I became a councillor in 2015, looking at different ways of working. We've got quite a flat structure. We work, I say, across two different councils, and we've always been very attentive to our financial situation. We knew that following the financial crash in 2009 and the coalition government that came in at that point, we were given pretty good warnings that funding for councils, district councils, was going to reduce, and we'd have to survive on the income that we had coming in from council tax and from business rates and whatever else we could generate. And so we'd already been addressing that. I can remember my very first meeting, I think, as a councillor, when we sat and looked at projections and we were looking at a huge potential deficit. We decided as a council that we were going to work with the officers in order to address that. And we have done, and we've been pretty successful now, I think, at being able to balance a budget every year since I became a councillor. Nothing specifically to do with me, but, you know, all my experience in that area has been that we've been pretty successful at it. And I think, you know, we've even now got to the stage where when I became leader of the council in 2019, one of the things I said to the chief exec at that time was that actually we want to do things as councillors as well. And so we work pretty hard at carving out part of the budget that we can use for our plan, and that is being invested in West Devon as well.
In your plan?
So there's quite a few things that are in the plan. I mean, housing is a big focus at the moment. We built a capacity for business support. We are looking, obviously, at working with our communities and making sure that we support the communities across the piece. We're working very hard on things like leisure, which is a very expensive area that we have, and we've got two leisure centres. So, yeah, there's a lot of things that are in there that we've invested in that I think, you know, are beneficial for the residents of West Devon. But more than that, as you said, we've managed to balance the books and make sure that, yeah, we're not in crisis, which I think is really important.
Okay, now one of the things that was mentioned a few years ago to bring in a bit of commercialisation to try and bring in some income for the council was putting a Premier Inn on a car park in Tavistock. Now that went down like a lead balloon in the community. Do you think the authorities' fingers got burnt by that?
Yeah, I think so. I think the main driver for that, I obviously remember it extremely well, was looking at the local economy and businesses in Tavistock in particular, saying to the council that we needed to do something to try and drive the local economy. One of our big local industries is tourism, and on the back of some advice that we had, that was something we decided to look into and see whether there was capacity there to build a hotel, which would have been a sort of would have been a budget level hotel, I suppose, within Tavistock. And I think it clearly didn't go down well with the local residents. And I think there was lots of discussion and debate around it. Ultimately, we withdrew the facility. I mean, I went at that time to a lot of local meetings and listened to what people said. And I think we decided that we did need to listen to the people in the area, and we did need to listen to other local businesses, and that it on balance, it wasn't the right thing to do. So we withdrew the application at that point.
I have to say I was editor at the Tavistock Times at the time, and I worked there for quite a few years, and that must have been the biggest story we had. For years and years, we had double page spreads of letters and everything on that story. It was a very big story. And I think We've often mentioned it before on here that it got national press, didn't it? Tavistock as the angriest town in Britain or something. So it was, and it really isn't that, is it? Normally, so
no, it's not.
But do you think there are other things that, as West Devon, you could possibly put money into that could you know, make you money and be good for the authority in the long run? Or is it just too risky? Because I know some authorities have put money into, you know, different housing, setting up housing firms, and they, you know, they haven't worked out. So
yeah, I think you've got to be really careful. I mean, some local authorities, as you know, have borrowed well in excess of what I think is prudent. And particularly if you put all your eggs in one basket and it doesn't work out, then you've got a potential problem. But you've got to make sure, if you are investing in something, that there is a benefit to the community. Now, that benefit might be, as investing in the leisure centres, for example, that there's a health and well-being benefit, and you're prepared to take that cost. Because one has to bear in mind, actually, at the end of the day, you're dealing here with people's council tax that they're paying, and so, you know, taking that risk. But at the same time, there are things that I think you can invest in, whether they be like leisure centres or like cultural facilities that are for the benefit of the community, and then you've got a cost to weigh up, haven't you? Or, as we have done with some investments that we've got, that they bring in an income. So we do have some property investments, and we have some property investments inside the borough and outside the borough. And those investments at the moment are bringing in around £300,000 a year net of costs to the council, to the council finances. So £300,000 a year is probably about 6% on council tax. And so I think, you know, those things are proving beneficial, because they're enabling us to spend that money on other projects that are going to make a difference to people. Mm. So it's a question of weighing up, but it's also a question, I think, of being sensible and prudent. And I think we've done those things reasonably well.
Mm. You said at a recent council meeting that you'd like to freeze council tax, but you couldn't do it because of Labour's policies that have come in. But isn't it just a case of Labour just changing the way they do things? Because you've also got £1 million in waste management funds that you're saying surplus to requirements, because you know, and you can use that on other projects because you don't need to improve your waste management.
Okay, so I think we need to think about that carefully. There has been an additional sum of money that's come in as a result of the packaging tax, which was brought in by the recent Environment Act. So that's been some time in the making. We received a payment this year, as far as I could see, completely out of the blue, and other councils will have had the same payment. And it's designed for councils to be able to improve and adapt their recycling programmes to take account of collecting all this packaging. We had already got a really efficient and effective waste recycling system that works really, really well. And so we haven't needed to spend that money directly on any of that. But costs have gone up in terms of our collecting process, because we use an outside contractor. And that contractor is going to get increase in their national insurance and other taxes that are increasing, and that cost will be passed on to the council and to our ratepayers. So part of that money has gone in that direction, and there are some other aspects of waste that we do need to look at, and we do need to improve that. The rest of that money is going into an earmarked reserve to do. But I think the point I was trying to make was that since 2009, 2010, the council has got its finances in order. We've had some really interesting, I think, additional sources of income coming in. And if I were the leader of the council, I really would want to be in a position of trying to freeze council tax. But we're just not able to because central government, it seems, are quite aside from not wanting to support local government, is still taking money away from local government. And that I find a bit disconcerting, but perhaps it's the nature of the beast.
Now, I've got maybe the two $64,000 questions just to finish off here. West Devon Borough Council has been led by an alliance since 2023 of independent, Liberal Democrat, Green and Labour councillors with the Conservatives in opposition. What would you have done differently if you were leader now?
I'm not sure there's a huge amount that I would have done differently. West Devon amongst the councils in Devon is unique in as much as it runs on a committee system as opposed to the cabinet type system. That means that posts on committees are allocated pro rata according to the number of councillors in your group. So we already have three members of the Hub Committee, which is the cabinet effectively, who contribute towards debate there. But I think more than that, in the previous council, we already had members of the Alliance within our decision-making committees. So we established a plan at that time, which we have essentially carried forward and was always designed to be carried forward for the first year into a new council. We had that plan reviewed under a peer scrutiny process, which said it was an excellent plan and everything was moving forward nicely. And I don't think there's been too many changes to that plan. So, I mean, as a way of operating local government, I think it's a really good system. It can be frustrating at times, but its very frustration is probably its strength, that you're having to take a number of different views into account when you put policy forward. So I think we already had a balanced and fairly apolitical policy program set up in the first place. So I'm not sure I would have done a huge amount different, to be honest, which is probably a really boring answer, but it's probably the reality. But I do think, you know, local government should exist to serve the people that live there. And I think at West Devon, we do that pretty well.
So building on from that, and this the last question is worth a lot more than $64,000. Local government reorganisation. The proposal is possibly to see West Devon merge with Teignbridge, Torbay and South Hams. Would Plymouth not have been a more suitable partner, given that West Devon kind of looks to Plymouth for many of its services, including health? Or is this very much not a done deal yet?
Well, the proposals are going forward, so the deal is not yet done. I think it's pretty clear that Plymouth has its own agenda. It would have been nice from our perspective, I think, for some alternatives to have been considered, not least because we've been in a joint local plan with Plymouth and South Hams. And you're right, certainly a big part of West Devon probably does look to Plymouth as its city. In other respects, I think, yeah, there are concerns that we all have about local government reorganisation. And one of those is just having units that are big and very widespread, because you've got to have a certain number of people according to the government guidelines living in a unitary council. Now, if that unitary council is based in Torbay and includes some of the districts that are in the eastern side of Devon, coastal districts, they're quite different from West Devon. How do we make sure that we get the right representation, I think, and the right attention to the policies that West Devon and the residents of West Devon need within that new structure? Now, ultimately, I think it comes down to service delivery. And yeah, we've got a number of services that we deliver pretty well, I think. I suspect that will largely continue, because how do you, for example, do your refuse and recycling in any different a way to the way you do it at the moment? So some of that stuff will continue. I think the things that are of concern would revolve more around the finances of any organisation, because if you've got a large rural area with a relatively small population and you've got to provide within that unitary council for the adult social care and child care provisions that are needed at that level, but you haven't got the income base because you don't have a big city within that with the business rates and everything else that attaches to that. How do you reconcile that, and how do you make sure that that balances? I think one of the concerns we always had about reorganisation in Devon is if you split it into two unitaries, you perhaps end up with a rich Devon and a poor Devon, and almost whichever way you cut it, West Devon probably ends up in the poor bit. So we've got that to try and grapple with as well. But I do know that, you know, at a district level, we're representing for the interests of the people at West Devon as best as we can. And we'll have to wait and see what proposals come forward later this month, which is when they've got to be submitted through to the government. So it will be interesting to see, but I think we've all got concerns about it.
There is actually a meeting on, because the first ideas have to be in by next week, don't they?
And that's right.
There's a meeting at Plymouth City Council next week with three different options on the table. The preferred one is bringing in some of the South Hams communities. But one of the other options is the housing market area and the local plan area. So that includes the whole of the South Hams, the whole of West Devon Borough Council. So it'd be interesting to see what the debate is on that on Monday.
I think it'd be really interesting. And I think there's an awful lot there to weigh up. But it will be interesting. I just think from the point of view of local politicians, we need to try and make sure that we get the best result for the people that live in Devon as a whole, in order to make sure that the service provision that people need can continue and can continue to be funded.
I suspect we might still be talking about this next time we have you in the studio. And
I'm sure.
Thank you so much, Councillor Neil Jury, for joining us today. I think that's probably a good place to end before we spend the rest of the afternoon talking about local government reorganisation. It's been great to have you here today, and I hope you'll join us again in the future.
I'd love to. Thank you.
You're listening to Devoncast from Radio X and the Local Democracy Reporting Service. It's available from your regular podcast provider and on Devoncast Radio across the county.
Next to Ukraine, where it's now a little over 3 years since the Russian invasion. This week, all the headlines are about a possible ceasefire and the involvement of the Trump administration in talks to try to bring about an end to the fighting. Two Devon MPs were among a delegation that travelled to Ukraine to see the situation for themselves and find out what people in Britain can do to help keep the conflict in the public eye and bring about a speedy conclusion. A couple of weeks ago, we spoke to Exeter's Labour MP Steve Race about the visit. Now here's Torbay MP Steve Darling, who was also part of the delegation. What did they get up to?
Probably the pivotal event that we participated in was the three-year commemoration of the latest aggression against Ukraine, because I think we've all got to remember that this is the second invasion that they've suffered from Russia. And that commemoration was interesting to participate in, as there was Zelensky was there. We had leaders from Spain, from Finland, from Sweden, from Denmark, and Justin Trudeau as well was there.
Yeah.
There was our chief of defence staff. I saw this man in uniform a couple of people away from me, and was like, hello, and he said, oh, I'm an admiral, and Tony whoever, and then he said, oh, which bit of the navy do you look after? And, no, I'm chief of all defence, so I look after the whole shooting match. It was very interesting to hear from him, because it's rare that as a backbench MP you get to hear from somebody in that really important situation about what has gone on, how we've supported them, and how could we be supporting them in the future, and where we are in discussions around boots in the ground, as well as working with partners around that world. So that was really helpful. And then I was a little surprised that there was nobody from the UK government there to commemorate when there's people like Justin Trudeau turning up. So it made it all the more important that we were there as a parliamentary delegation supporting it, because after the world leaders went up, we were the next line to put candles down to commemorate those who have fallen in the war so far. And also we went round a cemetery, and whilst I'm visually impaired, I can't really see it, or at least the pictures. I could see, so unlike our graveyards where you have quite a bland graveyard, there were hordes of flags as if it was, you know, like a carnival of Ukrainian flags and historic flags, or maybe flags to do with which division they were with, well decorated graves. And also the bit that really brought it home when Frankie, who went with me, my support worker, because Jenny couldn't go with me because guidance were unhappy about that, pictures of the people who'd fallen at the front. And they were mostly older people, actually, middle-aged to, you know, so surprising, because you always imagine, you know, the Vietnam War, you know, 19, the average age of the soldier there, but clearly it's much more older people petitioning, you know, there. And it was 2 hectares that's got over 1,200 graves in. And that was one of a number of graves in that single city. And clearly across the whole of Ukraine, that's repeated, you know, again and again. There were people sat by graves in tears, which clearly moved you to tears as well.
And the cross-party delegation of MPs was not spared some of the horror stories of a war happening almost on our doorsteps. Here's Steve Darling again.
And we went to, in Lviv, a place called Unbroken, where it's there helping soldiers get rehabilitated after having horrible injuries. When I was meeting with volunteers, they were sharing how people had been digging up mass graves to properly bury people after the initial Russian attack. And they'd had lost both hands because the Russians had buried mines in amongst the dead, which is really quite shocking. Yeah. That it would be evil to do that. And there was one gentleman whose nickname was Mario, because that was his ringtone on his phone, who was in a vehicle, and it had been attacked by the Russians on the front. It burst into flames, and he said he was lucky that his leg burnt off, because it cauterized his leg, otherwise he would have bled to death. Although he was sharing how for the last few hours of lying there, he was willing himself to die because he was in such pain, but the Russians were keeping drones around the area ready to pick off anyone who was going to come and help him, which seemed particularly inhumane. Those type of stories are really important to hear from people. You're hit knowing the human element of this.
The delegation also heard about some of the ways in which the rest of Europe is doing what it can to help, including one ambitious project involving farmers' old pickup trucks. Steve Darling explains.
You know, there are voluntary groups doing absolutely amazing stuff. Like there's Pickups for Peace, that is a really good organisation that's bought over, you know, hundreds of near end of life pickups to go and support the troops on the front line. It might be farmers whose defender is near the end of its life, but there's still enough life in the old girl yet, and they're able to get it up to decent standard over there, and if it gets knocked out in the not too distant future, it's not the end of the world. But there was a lady there when we met them at the town hall on the first full day there, who was testifying that her family member had been saved because they would have bled to death on the front if there wasn't a Pickup for Peace nearby there. I think it's just so important that we make sure that we are supporting the relief efforts that are going on out there. I know people like Unilever have given 1 million tampons to the cause, where it's supporting women on the front line who are fighting for Ukraine. It's reaching out to people like Tesco's and saying, can you give us, you know, so many pallets of stuff to support people out there. You know, we went with an organisation who is sending lots of humanitarian aid there to help people in the east of the country, but also helping, you know, the forces over there. So making sure that our communities locally are doing that grassroots level, but also being able to go back to Parliament, put written questions, write letters to ministers, and also when debates come up, come from a stronger position of understanding around this as an issue rather than an onlooker who wishes them well.
And it turns out the MPs were not kept well clear of the fighting. As you will have heard from the siren they recorded, which we played at the beginning of this Devoncast, they experienced the way ordinary Ukrainians are living through the war. And as Steve Darling explains, it didn't all go all that smoothly.
Sorry to give you this horrible image. I just stripped off, ready for bed, and I was, you know, in first full night in Kyiv, and then there's an app, as there is for most things in life, for air alerts, and this siren for air raid warning. So that goes off out of your phone, and it says air alert, danger to life. Don't risk it. Take to your nearest shelter now. And then it comes over the tannoys in your room, and you quickly throw a couple of garments on, and I'm there with my Doc Martens trying to get them on. But strange enough, the quicker you need to put Doc Martens on, the slower it gets. And you're thinking, at the briefing the other day, I've got 6 minutes before the warning and a potential hit, unless it's a missile, and then it's already got you if it's a missile that's getting you. So you're thinking, come on, I've got to get these bloody Doc Martens on, because otherwise, you know, I'm here in front of a big glazed piece of glass in my room.
Yeah.
So then you think, actually, I'm going to, I don't want to use the lifts. I'm going to use the stairs. And so fire exit, that's fine. I'm sure that will go down to the basement. No, I walk out the fire exit, door closes behind me, and then I can't open it. So I've now gone to being outside. And you're thinking, I don't think this is really going that well.
You're on your own at this point.
Well, no, there was an MP called Luke Dillon, who is MP for Newbury, who was with me. And we walked round the edge of the hotel eventually and came back through the main doors, and then found our way down to the bunker under the car park, near the car park down there. But as we were walking round, you could hear anti-aircraft guns firing up in the air. So that brought it home. Then it was down there. I decided that sleep was the best option. Some of our group were decided to watch Our Darkest Hour, which was quite appropriate for the Second World War.
Appropriate choice down
yes,
there, I
which
guess.
Was good. Yeah. Then it went, then there was like an all clear one that happened at 2 o'clock, and then back up to the room and on with the next day. There was stuff that happened, but nothing near us. Then the third air raid that we were involved in is when we were on coaches waiting to get on the train. So they'd had 3 special coaches, because we went to a conference at the end of it, because we weren't busy enough. And as we approached the railway station, the alerts kicked off, and you could see ACAC fire going off to one side of the road, and then we had an hour's wait until the train worked up for us. And then so we had 3 air raid alerts during the time that we were there.
So at the end of a whistle-stop couple of days experiencing the day-to-day life of Ukraine and its people, what did Steve Darling and his colleagues bring home with them?
For a major war to be happening in Western Europe is shocking. And they are the shield of democracy for the West of Europe. You know, this is all about whether you believe in democracy or not. I hope that Trump is playing a game at the moment of trying to get the best out of Europe by being mean and keeping them keen. And clearly it's worked with Starmer, where he's done the right thing. I would question where he's pulling out of aid, when actually 45% of aid for Ukraine used to come from America, but that stopped under the new Trump world. So that was, that's really challenging, but it is really fighting for our democracy is what it is about. And if Russia and Putin, you know, gets away with this and gains anything from it, he will be back again, and we need to just be alive to that. And so it's the privilege of my parliamentary career so far to have gone over to Ukraine as part of this delegation.
Now, Tourage has at last got the boost it's been waiting 2 years for after the government confirmed it would get more than £20 million to help lift it out of deprivation. The money, initially announced by the Conservatives in spring 2023 as part of a £400 million programme for communities struggling with low wages attainment and low life expectancy, will be spent on 12 projects put forward locally but selected by ministers and be spread out across the district from Holsworthy to Great Torrington, Westwood Ho and Biddeford. The money administered by Torridge District Council is focused on growth and creating good quality jobs by creating manufacturing and engineering opportunities, new agri-tech facilities and supporting the build of the Appledore Clean Maritime Innovation Centre, expected to be a leading global research centre in clean shipping. But there's also cash for a Biddeford Health Hub, a pannier market revamp, a housing development and social housing decarbonisation. And perhaps one of the surprise picks by ministers, not least for its community focus, was the Globe Hotel project in Torrington. The much-loved Globe closed back in 2018 and the building has been falling into a state of disrepair since then. Now the community has £520,000 to kickstart the renovation and bring it back to its former glory. It will become a training hotel and restaurant, creating 20 new jobs, and be owned by the community collectively, who will buy shares in the building. A community share offer will be launched next month, and the demand is set to be high given the nature of the building and the strength of feeling within the community. The project has been a dream for many years. Here's Chair of the Community Benefit Society, Torridge District Councillor and Mayor of the town, Doug Smith, to tell us more.
It was a former coaching inn and it was central to Great Torrington's success for many, many years. There's a lot of nostalgia involved in the building. A lot of people remember it from many years ago. Maybe their first dates were there, the first time we went for a dance and all manner of things. So there's a huge amount of sentimental feeling in the community. We had a public meeting till end of last year, and I anticipated probably 20 or 30 people would turn up, and we had in excess of 200, which was a sign of how important it is to the town. And lots of people stood up and said, this is the best thing we've heard for a long time. Yes, it's very, very important to all the townspeople. And the problem that we have is we've tried, this is about the third time we've tried to get this off. And for various reasons, because of funding and all manner of things, we haven't been able to really start. So we're concerned that the public are beginning to not run out of steam, but they need to know that something definite is happening. And something definite is happening. It's like a swan. There's lots of things going on underneath. It all looks very placid on the surface, but there's lots and lots of things going on behind the scenes.
Councillor Smith said without a hotel or restaurant in Great Torrington, it was a missed opportunity as the area was well visited for some of the attractions like the Plough Arts Centre.
One of the issues that we have when we speak to companies and organisations nearby is that people come to visit them and there is nowhere for them to stay. The nearest accommodation is either Biddeford or Barnstaple, for example. So we've had tremendous amount of support from Rosemore Gardens, for example, and Dartington. The Plough is a classic. So people coming into town have got nowhere to stay. They've got nowhere to eat. There are pubs that we can eat in, but not a sit-down restaurant. So one of the great things would be accommodation in the town. And when we looked at the accommodation, we thought, well, how do we service that? And at that stage, we decided we would turn this into training. So we would look to train local, not necessarily young people, but local people interested in the hospitality industry. We would train them up and use them and promote the hotel as a training establishment. The opportunity to come and work in a proper kitchen, in a proper hotel and gain really good experience and possibly even stay on. It's not necessarily a springboard, but we would look to do it absolutely properly. And that's really part of our ethos. Our ethos is everything is going to be local. We want to have local people in the place. We want to have local people involved in the rebuild. We want to source all our product in the hotel locally. So it's very, very much based on the town. And of course, the profits of the company will be ploughed back into other town organisations. They will not sort of go into the pockets of some wealthy shareholders. It's all going to go back into the benefit of the town. It's like a big jigsaw, all the pieces interlock. Some of the advisors we've been talking to have set up similar projects in other parts of West Country and Southern England. And they've always been very successful. The ones that we have been working with have said this is a particularly good one and it's better than some of the projects that they have been involved in the past, which have been successful. So they were very confident and almost suggested they were going to put their own pennies into it, but they were that confident. The response we've had, people are falling over backwards to help.
Councillor Doug Smith there, who's chair of the Community Benefit Society for the Globe Hotel project.
Now, a couple of weeks ago, we were talking on Devoncast about behaviour in the council chamber and how it's come to be under the spotlight in a couple of our local authorities. We talked about Teignbridge Council and how it's been taken to task for a catalogue of problems which has unfolded in council, ranging from swearing and shouting to muting one another's microphones. We could do that in here, couldn't we? I could just mute your microphone at any point.
Thank you.
A very different story, but one which also focuses on behaviour, has been unfolding at Torbay Council. A very large sum of money, officially put at just over £9,000, but speculated to be heading towards £15,000, has been spent on an inquiry into the events that followed a very bad-tempered council meeting last summer. At the end of the meeting, independent councillor Katya Madison, who was then part of the Prosper Torbay group, was moved to say shame on you to the council's chief executive, Anne-Marie Bond, as she walked past. She also posted her thoughts about what had happened during the meeting on social media. There was an inquiry and a meeting of the council's own standards committee, and Councillor Madison was told to make an unequivocal apology at the next meeting of the full council. That meeting's now come and gone, and Councillor Madison declined the invitation to apologise. Here she explains why and indicates that this matter is far from over.
I'm afraid I was never going to make an apology, and the reason for that is the sheer number of flaws that were in the complaints process. They're making the case that I do have something to apologise for, but I think that the law says quite differently, and I think they misrepresented the law. They used extremely concerning presentation of what they called evidence, and they completely missed my defence case out, and that is not what you call an impartial or fair presentation of facts. So it was never going to be possible to apologise. The solicitor that helped me during the hearing is actually currently preparing a letter which will be sent to the council, and we will be taking this further. And I think a lot of people, residents as well, feel that they are not heard and that there is no recourse for those things. And yes, they do support this business of trying to improve things in the council.
Torbay Councillor Katya Madison explaining why she felt she couldn't apologise as requested.
And that's Devoncast, your weekly podcast rounding up all of the county's crucial stories and talking to the people behind those stories. Thank you to Councillor Neil Jury for joining us in the studio today. Thanks for listening wherever you are listening and whatever you're doing while you listen. Don't forget to subscribe, and remember you can find us on Devoncast Radio on DAB across most of the county. We'll be back next week.
Catch the latest episode of Devoncast every Friday at radiox.co.uk or wherever you get your podcasts.